passionate love become brutal murder.
Dangerous couples feed off of each other. The results can be explosive.
A teenage crush ignites a wild killing spree.
She was even, in some ways, more violent than he was.
Husband and wife share twisted cravings.
He was looking for a schoolgirl.
And a love-struck girl becomes a deadly puppet.
She met Satan. She met the ultimate evil.
These deadly women had romantic dreams drenched in blood by dangerous liaisons. On a lonely highway, a killing spree is over. 11 people are dead, and 2 teenage rebels are under arrest. One of them is a 14-year-old schoolgirl, Carol Fugate.
You kidnapped me. I had nothing to do with killing them people.
Carol Fugate's story consistently has been that she was an unwilling hostage and not an accomplice, and she claims that to this day.
Is she truly an innocent hostage, or was her finger also on the trigger?
There was a term for her: high-tempered and easily angered and violent. I just think that once wasn't enough for her.
Lincoln, Nebraska, 1958. Carol Fugate is a sullen teen.
How are you doing? Come on, give me a hug. That's it. Oh, baby.
People said that she was a little snip and unevenly tempered.
Go and clean your room. I want you to make your bed now, young lady. I won't say it again.
Who cares if I make my bed?
Do. Now go and clean your room.
She didn't practice much self-control. You know, she did pretty much what she wanted to.
Sister's been a naughty girl.
She didn't like her parents very much, but that's not so unusual for a 14-year-old girl.
What is unusual is her choice of boyfriend. Charlie Starkweather is 19, a loner who worships James Dean.
What he liked about James Dean was his sense of James Dean having a solitary, lonely existence and didn't fit in with the world.
By the time Charlie was in his teen years, he hated society. He has said that he would like to live in a world where only he existed.
It's a dangerous liaison with a deadly secret. Charlie is an unstable killer.
He just had kind of a wild look. Something about his eyes that seemed to frighten people.
He shoots a man in a gas station robbery and gets away with it.
He felt good about killing. It made him feel powerful, and his self-esteem went up.
Author William Allen says Charlie and Carol became a frightening combination.
They both felt that they had met somebody who was like themselves. She was a dominant female, very aggressive and hostile. I think when two dominant people bond like that, they become so much bigger and more dangerous than they would be alone.
Carol's family is now in danger. The truth about what happens next depends on who you believe.
Charlie got in an argument with Carol's mother, and she said, "We don't want you to ever come back here anymore." He started arguing with her, and she started slapping him around.
Where is he?
According to Charlie, he kills Carol's stepfather, with Carol happily at his side.
And then shot Carol's mother in the side of the face at point blank range.
Even Carol's baby sister isn't spared.
Betty Jean, she was 2.5 years old, and Carol hated her, was jealous of her, because she was treated better than Carol had been treated.
Carol Fugate has a different story. She says she came home from school that day to find her family missing.
Charles told her he and his gang, as he described it, had taken her parents and half-sister hostage, and that they were going to, I believe, rob a bank or something, and that her parents would be released after they accomplished this. So that's how he was able to keep her in the house for this approximately about a week.
For the next 6 days, the couple stay holed up in Carol's house. A simple note keeps the world at bay. Charlie Starkweather has created his own paradise.
Charlie is known to have said that the 6 days following the massacre of Carol's family, where he and Carol drank soda pop and threw knives for practice and made love all over the house, were the happiest days of his life. What does that tell you about this man's life?
Fearing the police, Charlie finally takes Carol out of the house, onto the highway, and into a cross-country murder spree.
I think once Charlie started killing, he couldn't stop.
It will make him more famous than his hero, James Dean, and put Carol in the middle of a mystery. Is she a hostage or a killer?
She was willing and able to do anything that Charlie wanted to do.
No!
She was even, in some ways, more violent than he was.
In rural Nebraska in the 1950s, it's not unusual to pick up hitchhikers, even when they carry guns.
Hey, I was just wondering if we could get a lift about 5 miles down. We were just doing some hunting about a mile back.
Charlie Starkweather has just shot the owner of a nearby farm. Victim number 5. Carol Fugate is his hostage. Young sweethearts Bob Jensen and Carol King have made a terrible mistake.
They were the polar opposites of Charlie Starkweather and Carol Fugate. They were honor students. He played football. They went to church. They were the ideal teenager of that period, and they became the victims.
Just get out of there! Move it downstairs!
Take the car! Take it!
Fire! I have to do this!
The fate of Bob Jensen and Carol King still haunts former reporter Del Harding.
I arrived with the law enforcement officials looking down that storm cellar, and here's this half-naked body of Carol King and the bloody body of Bobby Jensen. I can close my eyes and see that just like it happened yesterday.
Turn around!
No!
Charlie admitted shooting Bobby Jensen 6 times. Just bang, bang, bang.
But with this murder, something came out of Charlie that hadn't been seen before, and that was an aggressive sexual nature.
Charlie took Carol King down into the cellar, and he was down there for 15, 20 minutes, something like that. When he came back up, Carol was furious.
What the hell have you been doing?
Because she thought he was having sex with Carol King.
You raped it, didn't you?
What happens next is still in dispute.
I can tell when you're lying.
Charlie Starkweather later swears that Carol goes into the cellar alone.
He heard a gunshot from the cellar. Carol came back and told him that Carol King had tried to run, so she had to shoot her.
Body is found. It has been horribly mutilated.
Carol Fugate supposedly took a knife and carved the private areas of Carol King.
It was a savage, savage attack on her female anatomy. Usually when we see that, where it is a male and female couple killing people, that's often an indicator that the female partner did that, and she did it out of jealousy.
But is Carol Fugate's hand really on that knife? Is she an accomplice or a terrified hostage?
She stayed in the car. She had no place to go. She was out in the middle of nowhere, middle of winter, and she was just frozen with fear. She thought she was going to be the next victim at any time.
James MacArthur's father, John, was Carol's defense attorney in 1958.
It's always been the belief, both of my father and myself, that Carol has been totally innocent of this. Carol realized very early on, she told me that there was something mentally wrong with Charles, and she wanted to break up with him, and that, in fact, is what appears to have precipitated the entire tragic events that followed.
It's Carol's rejection that sends an unstable teen over the edge, dragged along for the bloody ride. She's too terrified to escape.
Carol, 14 years old, she was with a person that she realized was a madman, that she had seen was able and willing to kill somebody, literally at the drop of a hat.
It certainly wouldn't be unusual for a person taken hostage by a killer to remain with them because they were afraid they'd be killed. That's totally understandable. I'm not at all sure that's what happened in this case. There are too many discrepancies, and there are too many statements from Carol that are quite simply unbelievable.
It's only when Charlie surrenders to police that she runs to safety.
Kidnap me. I had nothing to do with killing them people.
By then, there is a trail of 11 dead behind them. Charlie Starkweather pleads guilty and is sentenced to death. He also implicates Carol. Found guilty of first-degree murder, she gets life in prison.
I felt the same way as her jury did. She was a willing accomplice. Her demeanor, her testimony, all of that together, there was no doubt in my mind, and still is no doubt in my mind, that she was a willing accomplice and may have killed several of the people, the victims herself.
Carol was a very frightened person when I first met her, and she obviously felt that she was being wronged, that people didn't understand her. When I talked to her, and I was almost her same age, that seemed to be her strongest thing that she wanted to get across, that this was a terrible wrong that was being done to her.
In 1976, Carol Fugate is released on parole. She still maintains her innocence. In Queensland, Australia, the sleepy town of Noosa is laid back and carefree. The ideal place to raise a family. Today, that serenity will be destroyed.
27th of November, 1987. Will last in my mind forever, the day I die.
Pure innocence will meet a monstrous desire.
The last hour of Sean Kingy's life would have been absolutely horrific.
And one woman's name will become synonymous with evil. Val May Beck.
Anyone that could commit or participate in a crime like this isn't, I don't think, a human being.
In an Australian resort town, Barry Watts and Val May Beck seem like just another couple.
No one around here.
Well, what about her?
I told you I'm a bloody schoolgirl.
But their vacation is different.
I know what you want.
They are on a horrifying hunting trip.
Today's the day, Val. Little virgin. Gonna be a bloody first and last.
He's continually telling Beck that he is fascinated with having a virgin.
Alan Burke was working as a detective when the pair began stalking the streets of Noosa.
He was looking for a schoolgirl, a virgin schoolgirl, and that she was to assist him, and then he would be faithful to her for the rest of her life if she did that.
Like her!
Val May Beck doesn't flinch at her husband's appalling request. She will please him, even if it takes her to the depths of depravity.
I describe the relationship between Beck and Watts as a relationship that was born in hell. Had they not met, this may not have happened.
It's hard to say how a woman gets to a point of doing something horrible to a young girl because her husband wants her to. It takes years. It's not something that happens over a short amount of time. And the core personality of dependence has to be there to begin with.
Val May Beck began her life at the bottom.
She was in trouble virtually from when she was old enough to get into trouble, mainly for petty offences, stealing, breaking and entering, things like that.
Author Paul B. Kidd says she never made it out of the criminal underworld.
And just when she thought she couldn't get any lower, she met Barry Gordon Watts, skinny little rat-like runt of a thing who'd spent all of his life getting in and out of trouble with the police.
We need to make some money!
Why do you have your fat ass in
there? Don't you bloody talk to me like that!
They were a very, very good pair.
Barry Watts is much more than just another small-time villain. He has a warped obsession with young children. His dark urges ignite Valmet's.
Valmet fits the profile of a woman married to a sexually sadistic predator. And she became one herself. But it was always in her.
I can get you one of those, baby.
She was deeply in love with Barry Watts. I think that she wanted to please him, but I think that she bought into his fantasy life and she became very much involved with that fantasy life. She became very dangerous because of that.
Late afternoon, 12-year-old Sharn Kingi and her mother, Linda, have been shopping after school.
Sian Kingi was arguably the most beautiful girl at her school. She was loved by everyone. She was a champion at sport. She was good to her family. She was the daughter that every mother and father wished to have. She was an angel.
They live just minutes away. Linda thinks nothing of letting her daughter ride home on her own. Barry Watts and Valmet Beck wait on the other side of the park.
Don't you worry, something belongs.
This wasn't all Barry's crime. We know that the day it happened, it was Valmet that said to Barry, "Today's the day." She's the one who chose the victim. She's the one who got her.
You said today?
Settle down, all right?
At one point in Valmet's life, she was a little 12-year-old girl, and yet she had no empathy for what she was about to do to another little 12-year-old.
Shut up! Keep driving!
Riding home after school, 12-year-old Sharn Kingi is the picture of childhood innocence. She's also the ideal fantasy of a married couple with terrible desires. Barry Watts and Valmet Beck.
Watts has spotted her and said, "Here's one now."
Sharn doesn't normally talk to strangers.
Excuse me? Yes. You haven't seen my little dog, have you?
I haven't seen
but this
girl.
Homely woman seems
phone.
Harmless.
I'm that worried about her.
If you saw Beck in the street, you would think she was just another middle-aged woman, grandmother. You would never pass her off as a killer.
Oh, you're a good girl.
Sharn is forced into the car and taken away.
Don't kick me!
Minutes later, her mother comes looking for her.
Mom? Sean?
Something is very wrong. In a secluded area on the outskirts of town, Valmet tries to calm her terrified victim.
She did say in her interview that the little girl was whimpering. And she said to her that everything will be all right, to calm the little girl down.
Nothing's gonna happen to you. Comforting a child is something Valmé is used to. She has children of her own.
She's telling this child all the time, well, just go along, you'll be all right, nothing will happen. So she's behaving in quite a maternal fashion to this child, which it makes the whole situation even worse. So it twists maternity inside out, makes it something totally perverted.
Now Barry unleashes his most sadistic desires.
She stood by while Watts has raped Sean and sodomised her. He initially tried to choke her. He stabbed her numerous times in the chest area. And then he cut her throat.
As Barry takes a 12-year-old girl's life, Valmé stands by her man.
I don't believe for one second that she was frightened of him. I think that Valmé Beck had a choice from start to finish, a choice she chose not to exercise, which was to stop this murder. She could have stopped the murder at any point.
This is worse than animals. And she stood by and let it happen so that he would love her more. Think she's not evil?
Valmé does more than help her husband. She shares his twisted passion.
On Beck's word, they've celebrated the incident by having sex themselves. That's beyond me. You know, I just can't believe that a woman could do that. You know, it's beyond description.
Valmé probably got as much of a thrill sexually and psychologically out of this crime as Barry did.
1 week later, Sharn's mutilated body is discovered. A community is shattered.
It took away the innocence in life. I'd been around a while and seen some pretty awful things, but I think this really scars you to the core. My daughter was about the age of Sean, and I became extremely possessive of her in relation to her going anywhere by herself.
In the aftermath of such a savage sex crime, police believe they're hunting a man.
Didn't really enter into our heads that a female could be responsible for this as well. Very rarely do you get an occasion where you have the wife freely participating to assist the husband in such an horrific crime like this.
One clue turns the investigation. In a small town, strange cars tend to be noticed. A local enters the police station with a hastily scrawled license plate number.
So from that, I did searches, interstate searches, and came up with Valmé Beck.
When the pair are finally arrested, Valmé makes a cold-hearted confession.
She showed no emotion at all. Not a tear was shed.
Found guilty of murder, Valmé Beck and Barry Watts are given life sentences. In 2008, the heart that held no compassion for a child gives out. Valmé Beck dies in prison. Sharn Kingi would have been turning 31.
People put on this earth to do something positive, and leave it that way. She's come onto this earth, and the only thing she's done is, in her life, is killed a little innocent girl. That's her contribution to society. And as such, when I saw her die, I had no regret.
It's a warm Florida evening when Sandy Razzo arrives home from work and comes face to face with a killer.
Some shots hit Miss Razzo in her extremities, others that hit her in, you know, the body, and then there was one that was in her head.
Sandy will never know who or why. But this is no random slaying.
Before this, Tracy Humphrey had said, make sure you look into her eyes and you see the life drain from her eyes.
When 19-year-old Ashley Laney walks into a new gym in Tampa, Florida, she's intimidated by the hard bodies. Ashley's only recently left home. She's shy, lacking confidence, but immediately attracted to hotshot instructor Tracy Humphrey.
He's nearly 20 years older than her. He's an authority figure, and she immediately falls for this guy.
When you first meet Tracy, he gives you the impression that he really knows what he's doing. He's very confident and seems to really want to help people.
Toby White trained with Tracy at the gym, watching him move in on Ashley.
She was very bubbly, innocent. I started to feel protective of her. I could see how naive she was, how innocent she was.
Weeks later, Ashley's whole life has been transformed. She has a new body and a new love. But she's made a mistake. She's in the clutches of a monster.
Tracy Humphrey's background is littered with violence against women.
He had a very lengthy criminal history, spent time in prison. There were previous cases of him battering women in the past.
One victim is former girlfriend Sandy Razzo.
You don't say no to Tracy Humphrey, because he will get back at you for it. And Sandy Razzo said no to him more than once, but not this weekend. She says no, and he violently beats her and rapes her. She files sexual assault, rape charges against Tracy, and this becomes the beginning of the end for Sandy Razzo.
Tracy's new girlfriend, Ashley, isn't putting up a fight.
He's not only training her physically, he's training her mentally.
According to author M. William Phelps, he wants total control of Ashley.
He understands her, he reads her well right away, that this is a girl with zero self-esteem. And all I have to do is tell her what she wants to hear, and she's gonna be my puppet. She's gonna do anything I want.
He's chosen the perfect target. Ashley craves the control of a powerful man.
The men in Ashley's background were hardly stellar examples of what a man should be. Her father spent most of Ashley's life in prison. Her brother was in and out of juvenile facilities. Men who have a need to control women, to control everything in their life, would not be attracted to a strong, independent woman.
Look at me in the eye.
They are attracted to women who are looking for daddy.
One more. This is for us. Look at me.
That's exactly what Tracy wants. He needs a puppet to take care of some deadly business. Tracy's rape case is looming, and he cannot let his victim, Sandy Razzo, testify.
Tracy Humphrey had made a deal with himself. He would never, ever go back to prison. And he knew that a sexual assault case, a rape case, could put him in prison for 10 to 15 years, maybe 20 years.
Naive, vulnerable, Ashley will do anything for her man. To make sure she does, Tracy seals the deal with a wedding.
Tracy and Ashley get married inside the gym, go out for Chinese food for the reception, and for the nightcap, Ashley's gonna commit murder.
Ashley was only dangerous to one person in the world, and it was the person Tracy wanted her to kill.
At age 19, Ashley Humphrey should be putting on makeup for a night out with friends. Instead, she's getting made up for murder.
She had what she called a murder kit, and in that murder kit was oversized clothes, baggy clothes, oversized shoes, and black face paint.
He figured witnesses, if they saw her, would think, it's just a black guy. They would describe the killer as a black guy. And that's what he wanted, to throw off the scent.
From the safety of his couch, Tracy Humphrey will commit murder by remote control.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm putting it on.
Put it on your hands?
No.
I want you everywhere. I want you to look like a black man. Okay.
Tracy is a violent rapist, up on a serious charge. Ashley's job is to silence the only witness, Tracy's victim, Sandy Razzo.
Ashley agrees to murder her for Tracy. And the reason she does this is simple. She wants his love. She wants his love. She wants everything he's promising her.
Tracy and Ashley's relationship can, I think, be pretty well described two words. Master and slave.
On Tracy's orders, Ashley follows Sandy home from work.
Ashley was young and impressionable, but most importantly, she had a very, very strong need to be controlled by a man. In that regard, she was a sitting duck when Tracy came along, because he needed a woman to control.
Sandy pulls up in front of her condo, drives in the driveway, pulls into the garage, does not close the garage door.
From across town, yeah. The puppet master now dials in her death.
When you're done.
And he's telling her, you go and you do it. Then she runs into the garage. She grabs the pistol and she points it directly at Sandy Razzo's face. She begins to fire.
Sandy Razzo was shot 8 times. It was not the first shot that killed her. There was an apparent struggle. There were some shots that hit Miss Razzo in her extremities, others that hit her in you know, the body, and then there was one that was in her head. It would be a horrific way to die.
Before this, Tracy had said, make sure you look into her eyes and you see the life drain from her eyes.
I still can't get past the fact that she, on her own, walked up to somebody and shot them 8 times.
I think for Ashley, killing Sandy was a pretty easy thing to do because it was just one thing she had to do to keep Tracy in her life, and that was the most important thing.
Tracy thinks he's pulled off the perfect murder. His accuser is dead. He has a rock-solid alibi. But Tracy's need for control will bring him undone. Sergeant Scott Galzewski says cell phone records gave his team a vital clue.
Her cell phone was pinging off of towers shortly after the 911 call was made. And prior to that, they were pinging off of the towers, which were right by the location where Sandy Razzo worked at. So we started thinking, you know, she possibly was the one that, you know, committed the homicide.
It's gonna be okay. We can help you.
Away from Tracy's menacing influence, Ashley crumbles.
He wanted me to do it.
Who wanted you to do it?
Tracy. She was making up lies about him. He's gonna go to prison.
Ashley is not a stupid woman. There is no indication she wouldn't have had a very good life if she'd used her own brain. But she surrendered it. Her need to be loved by a man, a brutish man, took control of her life.
She needs someone to tell her what to do. And she met, really, Satan. She met the ultimate evil.
Ashley and Tracy Humphrey are both found guilty of murder. Tracy gets life. Ashley will spend 25 years behind bars.
Ashley ended one life and threw her own life away because she thought she needed a man.
I really believe had Ashley never met Tracy Humphrey, she would have never killed anyone in her life.
When these women met Mr. Wrong, their lives took a deadly turn. Carol Fugate's first love sparked a savage murder spree. Valmay Beck turned a sick fantasy into terrifying reality. And Ashley Humphrey became a puppet assassin. They were partners in crime who destroyed lives in a dangerous liaison.